hours in a day. And yet, what Mother Teresa, Albert Einstein, Bill Gates, and Martin Luther King Jr. accomplished in their days is a lot more than what many others have. The difference comes back to intention and attention. It's not that they had extra time. It's that they made time. When something is a priority in your life, you have to be willing to walk away from anything that's standing in its way. If there's something useless that's stealing your time, why are you letting it? Understanding that extra hours are not going to appear on your clock, how can you make the time to accomplish what you need to? It may be helpful to write in a journal for a few days, noting, truthfully, what you're doing all day long and how long you spend on each task. Are you spending more time than you realized getting showered and ready in the morning? Texting, emailing, surfing the web, gaming? Even positive things like reading or cooking can take up too much time when you're trying to get something done. When you need to finish a report or you still haven't turned in a long application, instead of procrastinating and sitting around thinking about it, invoke your bias toward action by putting your normal activities aside. Get the job done. Instead of cooking, open a can. Instead of reading the newspapers, save them for later or simply toss them. In the modern world, we have an endless supply of time sinkholes. Don't fall into them. Steal back your time to support your intentions. Getting Unstuck. Chapter 3. If it's not worth doing, it's not worth doing well. Anonymous. A drunk man is walking along the street and collides with a lamppost. He bounces backward and, after regaining his composure, again makes his way forward, only to again collide with the same lamppost and experience a similar backward bounce. Again, he regains his composure and then suffers another backward bounce. These actions are all repeated several more times. Finally, in frustration, he sits down on the ground and says, "I give up. They have me surrounded." If we're not drunk, once we see an obstacle in our path or experience our first bounce or two, we walk around that obstacle. Unfortunately, we sometimes still have difficulty. We often think we are surrounded and respond in the same way as the drunken guy. So, assuming you are sober, how do you walk around obstacles? Getting around the lamppost. The answer lies in changing the way you think about the problem. As an assignment in one of my design courses, I asked each student to find something in his life that bothered him and fix it. One student, Krishna, volunteered that his bed was broken and he could not seem to get a good night's sleep. His assignment was to solve the problem. This started a saga that lasted several weeks. The first week, Krishna reported not being able to find the correct wire to fix the frame. The second week, he reported not being able to find the correct tools. The third week, he was unable to find some small springs. Finally, I lost patience and told him that if he did not solve the problem by the following week, he would fail. He came in the next week with a big smile on his face. I knew the drama had ended. When I called on him to report on his project, he simply said, "I bought a new bed." It is a wonderful example of the mistake we make by working on an answer as though it were a question. Design thinking emphasizes that you always make sure you are working on the real problem. His mistake was that he originally tried to solve the wrong problem. He started by working on the question, "How can I fix the bed?" The real question, of course, was, "How do I get a good night's sleep?" This opened the solution space considerably and allowed a move away from the difficulties encountered in fixing the bed. Once Krishna started working on the right problem, the solution became easy. Get a new bed. This enabled him to walk around the self-imposed lamppost called fixing the bed. Moving to a higher level. Have you ever had a problem you couldn't seem to solve? You probably pondered solutions over and over, maybe losing sleep. I bet you were trying to solve the wrong problem. When you can't find the answer, it's often because you are not asking the correct question. To To illustrate this, let's take the question, how might I find a spouse? Just because it ends with a question mark, that doesn't mean it's a question. Drop, how might I, and you get a declarative statement. Find a spouse. This could be regarded as an answer. So we see that finding a spouse can be regarded as either an answer or a question. What question is find a spouse the answer to? There could be many. Some possibilities are, how might I get companionship? How might I get taken care of? How might I stop working? How might I have more sex? How might I get my parents to stop nagging me? How might I move to a better economic situation? How might I improve my social life? How might I keep up with my friends? Each of these questions, regarded as a problem, has many possible solutions. Finding a spouse is just one possible solution to each of these. In actuality, it may not be a very good solution to any of these problems. Experience has shown me that one of the main causes of losing sleep over a problem is that we think we are dealing with a question when in fact we are dealing with an answer, a solution that turns out not to be a good fit to our actual problem. A way around this dilemma is to ask, what would it do for me if I solved this problem? The answer to this can then be converted into a new, more generative question. If I believe that I want a spouse to satisfy my need for companionship, the real problem or question is, how might I find companionship? Finding a spouse now becomes simply one of many possible ways to find companionship. By changing the question, I have altered my point of view and dramatically expanded the number of possible solutions. The situation can be illustrated diagrammatically as, say you take a piece of paper, and in the very center you write the phrase, find a spouse, circle it a few times, and then you were to draw an arrow going down, and then writing the phrase, nothing works. Because I haven't been able to find a spouse thus far, I can take a different tack. I can ask what finding a spouse would do for me. Therefore, from my find a spouse in the center of the page, I could draw an arrow going up to get companionship by asking the question, what would it do for me? I believe it would give me companionship. So the next question is, how might I get companionship? And the diagram would look like this. We would have our find the spouse again, with the arrow going up to how might I get companionship? And then a series of arrows out of that leading down to other statements, such as find a spouse, meet friends online, take classes, get a pet, join a club, etc. I am no longer stuck with trying to find a spouse. It's that simple. Identifying what you expect from the solution to the problem you're stuck on brings you to a higher level and ultimately a better question. Changing the question is often enough to lead to a satisfactory resolution and to make the original difficulty disappear. In this example, if I figure out how to get companionship without getting married, the issue of finding a spouse becomes moot. This procedure can be repeated starting at the higher level. If the question of how I might find companionship becomes difficult to solve, I would ask, what would it do for me if I found companionship? Possible answers might be, I would feel less bored. I would get social stimulation. I would get intellectual stimulation. I would feel less lonely. Or I would feel more secure. By choosing the one that seems most resonant, we'll pick, I would feel less lonely, and converting it into a question, I get a new question. How might I feel less lonely is a long way from the original question, how do I find a spouse? Many married people feel lonely within their marriages, so clearly even solving the original problem, finding a spouse, might not solve my actual problem of being lonely. Now the situation looks like this. We started with find a spouse, which was the original problem. We moved it up to one level higher by asking, how might I get companionship? Then we moved two levels higher by asking, what would it do for me? And we get the question, how might I feel less lonely? Use this procedure whenever you find yourself stuck and losing sleep over an issue. Often it can open up a wide range of new solutions. The original problem disappears, and the way to proceed is immediately obvious. For this to work, you need to be honest enough not to hang on to the original question, no matter how comfortable you have become with hitting the lamppost. You need to be aware that there is a tendency to rationalize our dysfunctional behavior with excuses. Remember, we shy away from labeling them as excuses. Instead, we call them reasons. Of course, they are good reasons, right? There isn't always a single answer to the question, how would I benefit if I had a solution to my problem? It is simply a matter of using a different how might I question and repeating this procedure until you feel the aha that comes from recognizing your actual issue. I've had students say that they felt that this method does not actually solve the original problem. It simply replaces it with one you can solve. What they do not realize is that letting go of a problem is often the best solution. This is especially true when you're addressing the wrong problem. Blocks to success with this exercise happen when we can't let go of the original question. For example, in one of my workshops, a woman asked, "How do I make sure my daughter gets into a good college?" She had to struggle to admit that the main payoff for her in solving this problem would be to reduce her level of anxiety. Once she made that leap, the question one level higher became, "How do I become less anxious?" The new problem, at heart, was a long way from her daughter getting into a good college. In fact, it had very little to do with that. In all probability, once the daughter got into college, the mother would quickly find another issue to be anxious about. So if the mother were honest enough, she would start to work on the real problem, which is her anxiety. Your turn. To experience the process of walking around the lamppost, think of a problem you have been losing sleep over. This should be something that keeps bothering you and is directly related to your life, your relationships, or your job, and not something abstract or global, such as how to achieve world peace. Write this item down as a short, simple, how do I question. Then ask yourself what it would do for you if this problem were solved. In other words, if it were something that you no longer lost sleep over, what would it do for you? Write down the answer to this above your original question. Now, change the answer into a question and take a few minutes to consider possible solutions to this new question. If you're open-minded, chances are you have just walked around the lamppost. Alternatively, let's assume you are still stuck and don't see how to solve your new problem. Now we go up one more level. Take your new question and ask yourself what it would do for you if you solved that question, and write down the answer above the new question. Now we have a new question. Consider possible solutions to the newer question. You should soon realize that you just walked around another lamppost. Now, if after all this, the original problem has not disappeared, or you still don't see your way clear to the solution, there is a very good chance that you are not telling yourself the truth about what the real problem is and what it would do for you if you solved it. Go back and start again. Reframing. Once we are aware of a problem, we tend to plunge ahead in search of a solution. Yet often, we'd do better to first reconsider the question. Reframing problems can lead to much better solutions. Mental health professionals also use reframing. It is a powerful therapeutic technique. The basic idea behind reframing is to introduce a change of perspective into your thinking. This is illustrated in a variant of the classic light bulb joke. Question: how many design thinkers does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, from a design thinker: why use light bulbs? There are various forms of problem statements. In the business and design thinking world, they have names such as opportunity statements, how could we statements, and points of view. The form I favor is point of view, or POV. It's not a rigidly defined concept. Its purpose is to define what a person needs, not what we think she needs, rather what she actually needs. If you want to find something new, it's important to start with a problem and not with a solution. Once you introduce solutions prematurely, you shut down the discovery process. Reframing a problem is essentially a change of POV. At the D School, we've had several instances where reframing led to spectacular results. Students from the Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability course were asked to go to Myanmar to work on a project having to do with irrigation. As part of this work, they spent time with poor farmers to determine the farmers' basic problems with watering their crops. The students noticed that because there was no electricity, farmers used candles or kerosene lanterns for lighting. The students could smell the toxic fumes in the poorly ventilated farmers' huts. They also learned that candles and kerosene consumed about 25% of the farmers' annual income. In some cases, the farmers had old car batteries rigged to lamps so their children could do homework after dark. In these families, mothers were forced to repeatedly make tedious bike trips of several hours to get the batteries recharged. All in all, the Stanford students learned that lighting was a big issue for these farmers, so they convinced the teaching team to let them change their POV from dealing with the need for irrigation to dealing with the need for lighting. The students developed solar-powered LED task lights that were affordable and more user-centered than alternative solar lights. They established a for-profit company called D-Light that by the end of 2013 had sold over 2 million lights in 42 countries. They expect to continue to grow and provide affordable solar lighting to places in the world that have either no electricity or only intermittent service. In this case, it was a good thing that the students did not charge full speed ahead into the water issues. Rather, they reframed their POV to meet the needs they found on the ground. A different type of reframing was done by students in a project named Embrace. At the request of a medical nonprofit organization, students from the Entrepreneurial Design for Extreme Affordability course went to Nepal to deal with problems related to incubators for premature infants. The incubators cost about $20,000 each and are equivalent to the ones used in American hospitals. The problem the students were asked to deal with was twofold. The incubators were difficult to repair locally, and power disruptions often compromised their performance. While still at Stanford, the students thought in terms of battery backups and of redesigning to simplify the number of parts. Interestingly, once they got to Nepal, they noticed that the usage of even the fully functioning incubators was low. The more they traveled around the country, the more they noticed that only in towns did clinics have incubators. Many women living in the mountains would have great difficulty getting to them in time to save their premature infants. The students thus reframed their POV. They realized that rather than solving the doctor's problem of keeping the incubators functional, they should be solving the mother's problem of keeping their premature babies alive by providing the necessary warmth where and when it was needed. This led to the design of what is essentially a miniature sleeping bag with a removable pouch containing a block of wax-like material that, when heated, becomes a liquid that remains at the required temperature for nearly 5 hours. The heat could be supplied by boiling the pouch in water, which could be accomplished without electricity. The device they developed sells for 1% of the price of the conventional incubator and offers life-saving availability far beyond the domain of traditional incubators. The students' big breakthrough came when they realized that the initial question they were presented with, how to improve the incubators, was in fact an answer that could not work. By asking themselves what it would accomplish to have the incubator improved, they came to the real question. How could they keep babies warm enough to stay alive? In April 2014, Embrace's infant warmers were being used in 11 different countries on 3 continents. The warmers provided innovative, low-cost, life-saving technology for over 50,000 low-birth-weight and premature infants. The number of surviving infants is increasing daily. Reframing can also be useful in making improvements after a solution has already been found. Doug Dietz is a longtime designer of medical diagnostic equipment at GE Healthcare. He had a life-changing experience when he went to a local clinic that used an MRI machine that he had designed. He introduced himself to a technologist, She told him how highly regarded his machine was, and he felt 10 feet tall. Then a family appeared, trying their best to calm a screaming child. As soon as the young girl was exposed to the scary room, strangers, and the huge MRI scanner, she broke into tears and had to be sedated to hold still for the exam. Duck had no idea children were being sedated as a matter of course. When he found out that close to 85% of the children between 3 and 8 years of age had to be sedated, he felt like a failure. Shortly thereafter, while participating in a 3-day intensive executive education workshop at the D School, Doug got an insight about a shortcoming in his design process. He realized that although he had consulted widely with customer engineers, marketing people, salespeople, technologists, and doctors, he had actually never spent much time with the families and the young patients in need of the equipment he had designed. When Doug went back to work, he consulted hospital child life specialists, child psychologists, teachers, parents, and children. He enlisted staff from a children's museum. They spent time with kids and parents. He organized an advisory team of children who had undergone a lot of health treatments. Working with the children's museum and the children, he designed a series of MRI experiences he calls the Adventure Series. The Adventure Series reframes the MRI experience as an adventure and not a medical procedure. Doug did this by having the rooms, floors, and MRI machines redecorated. He also developed coloring books to explain the procedure for the child at home the night before. One adventure was going away to camp and being in a tent, where if you lie very still on a sleeping bag, the table, you can see the stars. Another was being in a ship lying very still, hiding from pirates. Reframing the situation from a medical procedure into an adventure was a huge success. The child sedation rate dropped to almost nothing. Apart from the savings in time and cost, there was a notable positive difference in the experience for the children and their families. Doug reports that after their MRI examination, some children would ask their mothers when they could return to have another adventure. The device was exactly the same, only the user experience was reframed. These three inspirational results illustrate an important basic principle, which is, when thinking about how to achieve your dream, don't simply charge ahead. Pause and think about what the problem really is. Go to a higher level and consider what else might be at the heart of the problem. Now, reframe it. Change your point of view. Then change it again and see where you are. The real problem will reveal itself to you. Why it won't work. Another useful technique for getting unstuck when you're solving a problem is one I accidentally stumbled on when I was writing my PhD dissertation. I had completed most of my research and had been invited to present a seminar on my work at Yale University. I had given a somewhat inflated title for the seminar. The evening before the talk, I started to think about my presentation and got a little nervous. I thought I should start off by coming clean about my title. I imagined myself saying, "Although my title implies I can solve the general case, the fact is that I can only do it for special cases. I cannot solve the general case where n is an integer. The reason for this is..." Then a miracle happened. As I was explaining to my imaginary audience why I could not solve the general case, it suddenly occurred to me how I could do it. I was thrilled. The next day at Yale, I gave my talk, and it went well. I felt good about the presentation and the fact that I didn't have to hide behind an inaccurate title. I still think it was one of the greatest aha moments in my life. Two important lessons emerged from this incident. The first is perhaps something you've heard before. If you get stuck while working on a problem, try putting it aside for a while. This process of mentally clearing the decks will allow your subconscious to have a crack at the problem, often resulting in new and better solutions. The second is to take the time to explain, whether to yourself or to a friend or family member, out loud, exactly why you can't solve the problem. In my case, when I explained to my phantom audience why I could not solve the general case, I was able to see that the reasons were not actually valid, and that I could do it easily using methods I knew quite well. Premature closure. When we're searching for solutions to our problems, we tend to choose the first decent idea that we come up with. Once we have an idea we feel we can fall back on, we tend to stop working hard and just go through the motions of pretending to look for better solutions. Or perhaps we stop entirely. Yet this too is a form of getting stuck. We are denying ourselves the opportunity to find a more practical, elegant, or inexpensive solution. This idea of premature closure can rear its head during any phase of any design or problem-solving process. When it occurs at the problem formation or POV generation stage, it leaves us working with the original concept for the problem statement. This severely limits the reframing, which is often the key to more effective and delightful solutions. If it occurs during the ideation phase, it can doom the project to a mundane, brute force solution. Better results can often be obtained if more ideas are generated and used to enhance or replace the original concepts. Consider the following problem. How do I increase my purchasing power? If I reach into my pocket and I find a dollar bill, I have a solution. If I keep looking and find a $5 bill, my situation has improved. Further searching might reveal a 20. If I am lucky, upon opening another compartment in my wallet, I find a blank check and maybe various credit cards. Now I have a lot of options to choose from, and I could combine or use any single one that I feel is best for the given circumstances. Either way, I have come a long way from my first solution, a single dollar bill. The proper state of mind is one that welcomes each subsequent solution with as much joy as the first one, and then puts each aside and keeps looking. Ultimately, you'll face restrictions that will end the solution-seeking process. You'll run out of time, you'll run out of resources, or you'll find the solution that you're sure is exactly the right one and no longer be tempted by the challenge to find something better. What we don't have. One spring day, I was riding my bicycle in Death Valley when I came upon an astonishing sight. A section of the roadway was covered with thousands of dead caterpillars, squashed flat by cars as they attempted to cross the road. Looking more closely, I could see masses of caterpillars on each side slowly making their way toward the road. There were as many on the left side of the road, headed to the right side, as there were on the right side, headed toward the left. This was barren country, and as far as I could make out, the landscape was identically empty on both sides of the road. What motivated the caterpillars to cross? I have no idea. Probably entomologists have a good reason. Yet the memory has stayed with me as a constant reminder of analogous, meaningless, dysfunctional behaviors in my life. How many times have I crossed a road pointlessly when staying where I was would have been fine? Like those caterpillars, we are often more interested in what we do not have than in what we have. We may strive for something, and the effort may consume us. Once we have obtained our goal, it tends to lose its hold on us, and we are off to the next pursuit. Currently in America, approximately 50% of marriages end in divorce. Many of these are followed by remarriages. We are always looking for something different, something better. People change jobs because they get bored. They travel not for the joy of traveling, but simply to get away. It is common for people traveling to other cities and countries to visit museums, even though they never bother to go to the ones in their own hometowns. In some people's lives, there is constant change for change's sake, like the caterpillars crossing the road to reach an identical piece of Death Valley real estate. Maybe going from one place to another does no harm, or maybe you get flattened while you are crossing the road. Some professions have motivation for road crossing behavior built in. In sports, there is always the next game and the next season to work toward. In research, there is the next project and the next paper, always more knowledge to achieve. In school, there is always the next exam, class, and term. Then there are the various levels to graduate from. Grade school, junior high school, college, and graduate school. In jobs, we work our way up the ladder, always looking ahead. In these examples, at least, there seems to be something bigger and better on the other side of the road. In all these examples, you will see that what has been left behind was at one point something you desired most in life. Yet now it hardly matters to you. There is nothing wrong with change and moving forward in life if it gets you to a better spot. Unfortunately, all too often in our search for the next big thing, we don't take the time to appreciate the satisfaction of achieving a goal, or the process itself. We are so busy being enticed by our next endeavor that we forget to savor what is already there and could be deeply meaningful. It is useful to remember the adage, the more things change, the more they remain the same. A good case in point comes from a colleague of mine who made some important discoveries and became very prominent in the area of applied mathematics. Periodically, he would win some award or receive an honorary degree. Invariably, he would tell me about the next honor he was hoping for. Then, when he got it, he would tell me he was pleased because he could use it to get a pay raise in the coming year. In fact, he was unmarried, very well paid, and had no need of extra income. In spite of his many successes and his many raises, he was basically an unhappy person. Sadly, he reminded me of the caterpillars, always hoping to find something on the other side of the road, although it was all around him, already on his side of the road. Often the things we strive for only represent more of something we already have: money, fame, appreciation, love. It's an endless chase. As the saying goes, you can't get enough from more. For some people, it's the thrill of the chase that they really enjoy. So once they get what they have been seeking, it becomes irrelevant. There's nothing inherently wrong with this as long as you are honest with yourself about your goals. Otherwise, you are bound to spend your life frustrated and unhappy, like my friend. There is an ethos regarding change in Silicon Valley. Within many companies, there is always a fierce struggle to develop something new in an effort to stay ahead of competitors. Silicon Valley people believe their companies will stagnate and die without continual innovation. It's the ultimate "what have you done lately" culture. To maintain status in such a culture, people always need a new and evolving story. If they don't deliver, they feel they lose face. These people are under a lot of pressure, and in their desperation, they sometimes act like those caterpillars, taking their organizations on meaningless road-crossing journeys in pursuit of a new story to tell their friends. The moral is that change for change's sake is not necessarily good. Sometimes it's okay to fail in the pursuit of a meaningful goal. But it is never okay to commit organizational suicide just to save face with your friends or impress your latest love interest. 22 Ways to Get Unstuck. Once you have a problem statement, there are many formal methods that can assist you in generating solutions. Moreover, as you move forward in the problem-solving process, it's important to keep in mind that all problem statements, including POVs, are best regarded as provisional. Subsequent work often leads to multiple revisions of the problem statement. Often, just getting a good problem statement is enough to set you on the road to a great solution. At other times, a satisfying direction is not apparent, and frustration sets in. My dear friend Rolf Fasta created the handout that follows for our creativity workshops, listing 22 things to try if you find yourself hitting the lamppost. I've never lost my admiration for Rolf's incredible ability to use simple sketches to bring complex ideas to life. In only one page, he succeeded in beautifully summarizing the major tools from the product design culture that developed into the design thinking movement. Let's now go over Rolf's list. 1. Hard work. This is my most productive technique. Sometimes things come to me in a flash, but most of the time the flash is preceded by a lot of hard work and frustration. There are no magic methods that substitute for attention and intention. 2. Create a supportive environment. Take time to unclutter your work area and keep supportive supplies handy. Make your surroundings remarkable and stimulating. Abraham Verghese had a poster printed saying that the book he was working on had won a Nobel Prize and had been on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year. He did not get the Nobel, but the other part came true. 3. Relax. To allow your subconscious to do its work, you must relax. There are many stories of people having breakthroughs during their dreams and daydreams. My favorite has to do with the Irish astronomer and mathematician W. R. Hamilton, who was walking with his wife when the solution to a long-standing problem popped into his head. History doesn't say if his wife knew he was daydreaming while supposedly spending time with her. Without exposing the details, which might put my marriage in jeopardy, I can affirm that this method works. 4. Brainstorming. In the Stanford Product Design Program, students are taught to use a problem-solving process. We call it a design process, with the acronym ETC. The first step is to express an idea. Come up with a trial solution. The next step is to test the idea, see what about it works and what does not. The third step is to cycle. Use what you have learned to come up with a modified or new idea, that is, something new to express. This is repeated until you have a solution you are proud of, or until you run out of time. In general, the express part of the process is generative. Your attitude here should be one of optimism about your idea. In contrast, when you get to the test part of the process, you need to change attitude and become a skeptic. Push yourself to find out what needs to be changed. In this way, you need to flip attitudes as you cycle from express to test, and from test to express. Two major tools are useful in this process. One is brainstorming, and the other is prototyping. Brainstorming is perhaps the most familiar of all the methods in the diagram. Sometimes the word is used to simply describe a person coming up with ideas. In our context, it refers to a more formal procedure through which a group of people gather to deal with a specific issue. The object is to come up with many varied ideas. We call this fluency and flexibility. Ideally, a brainstorming group is chosen that represents enough variety of experience and knowledge that people can naturally build on each other's ideas, piggybacking, and also jump into completely new ideas, leapfrogging. Brainstorming sessions are not supposed to be evaluative. They are meant to open up possibilities, no matter how far-fetched. Thus, a basic rule is to defer judgment during the session. This is a somewhat unfortunate phrase, implying, as it does, that the judgmental hammer will soon come crashing down. A better description of the participant's desired state during a brainstorming session would be gleefully accepting. Wild ideas are encouraged. Usually, a recorder or facilitator monitors the session to make sure people stay on the topic and that there are no cross conversations. The rule is, one conversation at a time. Brainstorming in a group has the advantage of getting you out of your own head and letting you build on the ideas of others. Some people are loners and don't need others. I have a friend who is a great designer who hates brainstorming. He tells me he gets his best ideas during long, solitary jogs through the mountains. Obviously, most of us can profit from other people's ideas. Diversity of backgrounds can lead to solutions that we might not arrive at on our own. 5. Lists. A list is a very simple and useful problem-solving tool. As the word implies, just make a list of all the possibilities. The trick is in generating a list inclusive enough to move you toward a solution. When Paul graduated from college, he decided he would figure out his future by using lists. First, he made a list of all the things he wanted out of his career. He listed things like, be my own boss, use my engineering training, do some public relations, use my drawing ability, travel, have time for my family, and be located in the San Francisco Bay Area. Although the list was longer than this, you get the idea. It led him to a part of the solution, which was he needed to own a business producing something for which he could be involved in all aspects, especially development, production, marketing, advertising, and sales. The next step was to find a product to build this business around. Again, Paul used lists. This time he copied out the names of every type of product in the Yellow Pages. He spent a long time going over each product and thinking about whether it would be something he could build a business around, and which would satisfy his criteria in the original list of what he wanted out of his career. Using this process, he found an unlikely product, a secret recipe for beef jerky. It turned out to be incredibly successful, both making a large financial profit and satisfying everything on his career list. 6. Meta lists. These are lists that contain the names of things from which to make more detailed lists. For example, you make a list of places to visit, and then separate lists of things to do for each place. 7. Morphological analysis. This is the process of matching up elements from different columns of attribute lists. For example, if we want to design a clock, we could make a column listing power sources, for instance, batteries, AC, mechanical, solar, water, a column listing timing mechanisms, gears, escapements, vibrations, pendulum, and a column listing indicators, two hands, three hands, LEDs, digital wheels. By forming all possible combinations of these elements, we automatically generate a large number of alternatives for clock designs. When attribute lists have many items, this method lends itself very nicely to computer implementation. 8. Idea logs. These are notebooks in which you sketch out your ideas using drawings, words, and even pasted-in items to create a record of tangible speculations on your part. It's good to develop the habit of creating notebooks in which you record your ideas. Without a record, ideas are often forgotten and lost forever. The most famous idea logs ever created were the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. I have found many lesser mortals can also profit by using this tool. Unlike Leonardo, however, many people actually get a lot of things from their idea logs implemented during their lifetimes. 9. Humor. This is a great idea generation tool. Even for very serious problems, joking around can get you where serious thought is afraid to go. 10. Conversation. Some people are very secretive about their problems, and, consequently, they are often on their own. It is not a healthy psychological state to be in, and often not very productive. There are countless stories about how, in the famous idea factories of Bell Labs, Building 20 at MIT, and various Silicon Valley companies, casual conversation led to a big breakthrough. Talking to people is a great way to stimulate ideas. 11. Forced transformations. This is the process of purposefully modifying your ideas to make the conventional into the unconventional. Alex Osborne, the famous early creative guru, created a checklist of possible modifications, with items such as magnify and minimize, which referred to changing the scale of an idea. This method can be extended to include any type of transformation. For example, you can combine two unrelated ideas, such as fish and tower. If you make yourself a deck of cards in which each card lists a single transformation, you can generate a lot of ideas all by yourself by simply following the transformation on each card. If you lay the cards end to end, it looks a little like a game of solitaire. 12. Synecdoches. This term, derived from the Latin word synecdoche, means the joining together of different and apparently irrelevant elements. In this context, it stands for the use of analogy to come up with solutions. The method calls for thinking of situations or items analogous to what you are working on in the hope that the analogy will reveal a better idea. It is useful to consider analogies that are directly related to the situation under consideration and also analogies that are personally related to the problem solver. Another useful concept in the synecdoches framework is the compressed conflict, a combination of two concepts that seem contradictory. Safe attack, for example, one such combination, was central to the development of the concept of vaccines. By using a safe dose, we attack the body with a mild case of a disease so that it produces antibodies that will protect it. Thinking of the problem along these seemingly contradictory lines opens new avenues to us. 13. Diagramming physical process. This is a tool used to distill problems to their essence. For some types of problems, idea generation can be aided by plotting some performance variable against time or another variable, or by drawing flowcharts that represent an entire process. 14. What if? This is a great way to start a question during idea generation. What if there was no gravity? What if there was blast-off house paint? What if there was a joke-telling trash can? These questions, by taking us off the main track, create an irreverent attitude that leads us to question assumptions about the problem. 15. Decision-making matrix. This is a good way to compare different ideas by creating a matrix in which the rows represent the different ideas and the columns represent attributes within these ideas. For example, in Choosing a Bride, Kumar labeled each row with the name of a different candidate and each column with an attribute such as education, appearance, wealth, or family. Assigning a number to each matrix element transforms the comparison to a quantitative measure. Adding all the numbers in a row gives a total score for that idea. Also, weighting factors can be used to prioritize certain attributes. 16. Working backward. Imagine that the problem has been solved, and then work back to the beginning. This way you can see what all the milestones are. If nothing else, this method is great for scheduling. 17. Storyboards. These aids for sequential planning are well known in the movie industry. They can be used anytime you want to tell a story in a linear manner. They are, in fact, a very pictorial version of the journey map, a diagram showing a linear sequence of events. 18. How-why diagram. This diagram can be used to redefine a problem, much like our method for changing the question. The idea is to generate a diagram showing a string of causes and effects. For a given problem, the diagram lists a way of doing something, the how, and then why it is done. A lot of ideas can be generated this way. There are many variants, such as the how-why-why diagram or the why-why-why diagram. These diagrams are loosely related to the abstraction ladder, which is based on S.I. Hayakawa's ladder of four levels of linguistic abstraction. The bottom level consists of concrete things, swimming goggles, a telephone, a mug, and so on. On the next level, there are groups of concrete ideas, schoolchildren, power tools, cars, livestock. The third level consists of broader groups, women, men, movies, communication devices, decorations. At the top level, there are more abstract concepts, communism, power, fairness, success, good, evil. By diagramming the levels of abstraction for the problem-solution, you are better able to see if you are working too narrowly, being too specific, in which case you might want to redefine the problem. 19. Nasal thinking. This is my colleague Jim Adams's term for the use of different cognitive styles. The idea is to be flexible in the way you look at things. Try to imagine what you would do if you thought with your nose or tried not to speak. In this way, you see your problem differently and open up new solution ideas. Adams's classic book, titled Conceptual Blockbusting, contains a lot of other tools for overcoming blocks to creative problem solving. 20. Mind maps. These relationship maps diagram the connections between pieces of information in a nonlinear manner, supposed to be analogous to the way your brain stores information. Mind maps are great for providing a broad understanding of how diverse parts relate to the whole. Before the widespread use of computers, most information was stored linearly. Now we all do computer searches in non-linear ways. This gives us an experiential understanding of the saying, neat notes contain messy information. Messy notes contain neat information. To make a mind map, start at the center of your space and write a word or short phrase that will be the main topic. Then see what other idea or word this evokes and write it a short distance away. Connect the two words with a line. Next, go back to the first word and see what else it evokes. Write this new word in another direction and connect a line to it from the first word. Keep repeating this process until you run out of ideas. Then use each of the secondary words as a root and repeat the entire process. Of course, I have explained this in too linear a manner, and the words in the map can be generated in any order the connections come to mind. 21. Meta summary. This is a tool for what is sometimes called visual thinking. Here we approach a problem using our visual abilities to see, draw, and imagine. We can generate new ideas by drawing things that we see and things that we imagine. We seek solutions by bringing together results from these different aspects of visual thinking. The overlap among different aspects is represented graphically by a Venn diagram, in which each aspect is shown as a circle, and our attention is called to the ideas in the area where the interiors of all the circles overlap. And finally, 22, diagram yourself. In this method, you examine your own problem-solving process and strive to be ambidextrous, meaning that you use both right brain and left brain activities equally. In one variant of self-diagramming, one person lies down on a long sheet of rolled-out paper on which another draws around his body to make an outline. Then the first person labels each part of this body outline with comic strip-type balloons containing whatever terms come to mind, thus balancing the intellectual-verbal with the emotional-visual. In Chinese terms, you are striving for balance between yin and yang. In my view, it's not useful to jump from method to method. Instead, it's better to become adept at a few problem-solving strategies and stick with those. The more you practice your chosen techniques, the more easily you can unblock yourself at will. Finding assistance. Chapter 4. If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten. Anthony Robbins. When it comes to achieving what you want in life, it's rare that you can do it entirely on your own. Often, you'll need a little assistance from your friends. It's said that it's not what you know, but who you know. I agree with that, though in its less cynical form. We are all better off when we assist each other to figure things out. Learning from everyone. I have found colleagues to be sources of enduring wisdom. My colleague Tom taught me, as well as his students, that we don't have enough time to hurry. This means that when you do things in a rush, you are invariably going to mess up. It will take you more time to clean up the mess than if you took the time to do it right. Tom's advice always comes to mind when I'm fumbling with my key in a futile effort to speed up the bike locking process so I can rush to an appointment. My colleague Henry left an indelible impression on me one afternoon as we were biking home together. I excitedly told him I had just made a great research discovery. He asked, "Is it good enough that you can describe it before we reach my turnoff at the next corner?" Unfortunately, it wasn't. Henry also told me something that one of the kings of England said to his son. "Whenever you get a chance to either sit down or to go to the toilet, take it, because you never know when your next chance will arise." The wisdom behind that advice became clear when I sat in an auditorium with 1,000 other people, waiting, uncomfortably, for a very embarrassed famous author to return after having interrupted his reading mid-sentence to use the bathroom. I have found that this royal advice works especially well for teachers. One of the most important things I have learned from colleagues is how not to be. I had a colleague who was basically a nice person, I never experienced anything except kindness from him. Sadly, though, he treated a junior staff member who worked directly for him shabbily, forcing the staffer to move to a different university. After seeing this, I resolved to be especially concerned with treating younger colleagues fairly. An administrator once told me I was a reverse ass-kisser, meaning that I treated underlings with more deference than I did my supervisors. I took that as a compliment. The fact is, we can choose to learn from others.